Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. I believe that information shared on today's program could be a game changer. I would suggest that if you agree with what is shared, you share it every place you can. We all know that there is an enormous battle occurring. It's not a battle against COVID. COVID is a real virus. It is able to kill people and has. It should be taken seriously. Even the variant, Delta, is particularly alarming for younger people. And Dr. Luc Montagnier, who discovered the HIV virus, won the Nobel Prize for it, says that the variants are coming from the vaccines. But what if everything you were told, I mean everything, was based upon a false premise about the severity of this? Well, that's exactly what we're going to share a little later on in today's program. We have a professor, highly distinguished, Professor Norman Fenton, F-E-N-T-O-N. He's a noted British mathematician. He sits at the main table of mathematicians in Great Britain, if not the world. He's Professor of Risk Information Management at Queen Mary University in London. And he also is the Director of Research in Risk Management for Critical Systems. He's published 7 important books, 230 peer-reviewed articles. He has consulted with the BBC on their documentary Climate Change by Numbers, which he is one of the co-presenters. He also has won a lot of awards, the American Association for the Advancement of Science Journalism Gold Award for, quote, best in-depth TV reporting, European Society TV and New Media Award for the best science program on the environmental issues, Faculty of Science and Engineering Research Award from Queen Mary University, and he's one of the world's 15 top scholars for the third time. So he's no lightweight. I want to give you that background because every single guest we've had, every single report we've given have come from the best and brightest of orthodox science, pro-vaccine, medicine, and science. So wait till you hear what he has to say. It'll be in about 10 minutes, 15 minutes. But then we have other commentaries today. We'll have Richard Gale on, and we're going to give you what has happened worldwide in the last 30 days. And here's a question. Is it possible with all this terrible information, 25 people dying in New Jersey by drowning, first time that's ever happened, and record-breaking rain, record-breaking death from that rain, and fires, that we've chosen not to do anything? In fact, we're actually going in the opposite direction. More people, according to this latest report, are moving to the worst environmental areas, the most dangerous areas in the United States. How's that possible? That will be a question we're going to ask you to call in and answer after you hear all the statistics on that. Also today, we've seen the media, as mainstream media, has gotten away from Taliban taking over Afghanistan. Let's get to other issues that we can control. All right. Well, we haven't gotten away because there's 250,000 Afghanis who work for the government, and all their biometric material, their photographs, fingerprints, all of that has been given over to the Taliban. So now they're going door to door searching for these people. All the women advocates are being searched for to be killed. And that's happening every day. Also, there was one section holding out, one area only 30 miles from Kabul. It's landlocked. It's a very famous valley that even the Russians couldn't defeat the people there. Well, they have fallen in one day. How'd that happen? Something that no one in the media will share with you. Today we'll tell you how, in less than 24 hours, with no chance in the world of defeating these people, there's 120,000 to 200,000 of them live there, how in the world did they lose? You'll hear who was behind it. The United States and all of its agencies knew about it, and not a word was spread in any of the media. But when a professor, who's an expert in Southeast Asia, Affairs was invited onto the BBC. The moment she mentioned this country's name, she was censored and cut off. Well, we already know that the BBC is a propaganda machine and should never be trusted unless it's verified. So you're going to hear something, the fall of Panshire, and whose fingerprints were all over it, and what proof is there. Also, from a 60 Minutes archive, women describe life under the Taliban the last time they were in power. It's going to be even worse this time, because they control the whole country, and they're getting support right now, as we speak, from Russia, China, Iran, and Pakistan, the United States. How'd that happen? Also, if we have time, when your partner tries to stop you from growing. Interesting short clip on motivation. So that's our show. We have a lot to share. And of course, we always begin with the latest on health. Pomegranate, the peel in particular, has protective effects against enteropathogenic bacteria. This is from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And this was published in the Peer Review Journal of Nutrition. Now, we know that when you eat pomegranate, you're getting nitric oxide. And we know that that helps expand your arteries and your veins, and that allows greater blood flow to the brain and to the extremities. And it helps give you better circulation in your calves, because a lot of people I counsel have intermittent claudication and they don't exercise enough. They should have. Look, if you can afford a leg press, you should have a leg press. They're not that expensive. You can get them for as low as $500. But boy, does it do a lot of good for your legs, your calves, all the veins. They really help you in the muscles, because it's one of the things that you start to lose muscle mass as you get older, over the age of 40. And this is one way to get it back. In any case, the pomegranate, the beet juice, the rhubarb, and other fruits and vegetables, they're rich in the supplies. So we know the pomegranate, the actual juice from it, helps to heal the tiny little tears and cuts in the epithelium, the lining, which can cause clotting. So it's great to prevent heart attacks. We didn't know the peel was good at this level. And why? Because according to this study, it's rich in polyphenols, and like munichalins, M-U-I-C-A-L-I-N-S, and ellagic acid, E-L-L-A-G-I-C. Now, these are chemicals. You could have 200, 300, 400 chemicals per fruit that we know of. A lot more we don't. And these all have functional ability in your body. That's why the more fruits and vegetables you eat, the more juices you drink, the more enzymes you flood your body with, the more these start to heal the body. So pomegranates are terrific. They have antibacterial action. And so this is just one more thing that they can do. They can help with E. coli. And E. coli is a major problem in the United States. And generally you get E. coli, if you're the average person, by not thoroughly and completely washing your fingers and fingernails after you've your fecal excretions, and you don't realize when you're using toilet paper, that can go right through the toilet paper, right onto your hands. And then people just stick their hands under the water for a second, and you've got to scrub the hands and fingernails for at least 22 seconds to help eliminate that. But that's where people get infected. Or you go to a restaurant and you order a salad, healthy salad. You don't know who's touched the salad. You don't know if their hands were clean. So it is very common. One more reason why. Pomegranate fruit peel contains bioactive compounds that can help reduce the severity of these infections. Something else that's important, this is from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and the Harvard School of Public Health. A new study shows that vitamin D can protect against young onset colorectal cancer. So consuming higher amounts of vitamin D, mainly from dietary sources, may help protect against development of young onset colorectal cancer, or what we call precancerous colon polyps. And that's the first study to show such an association. There are tens of thousands of studies in PubMed concerning vitamin D alone. It does so many good things. But according to this, it can help. While the overall incidence of colorectal cancer has been declining, And I believe that is mainly because people going towards a high-fiber, healthier diet, plant-based diet, but younger people are not. The majority of younger people are going towards the pizzas and the hamburgers and the things you see on television. They order them in. Understandable. Inexpensive. Fills them up. They develop a taste for it. Salty and crunchy. Soft and sweet. Now, older people are adhering to a more healthy diet. And there's a segment of the younger people who were influenced more often than not by their family to eat a healthier diet. But for the average person, you shouldn't be seeing colorectal polyps in young people, and certainly not colorectal cancer, nor heart disease, nor arthritis. We're seeing all those in young people today. So one more reason to take your vitamin D3. Also, from the University of Pennsylvania comes a study about when you set your own exercise goals, but then immediately pursue them, it's more likely to result in lasting positive changes. And that's according to this, the Perelman School of Medicine at University of Pennsylvania. And that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Cardiology. So most behavioral changes, if we are the ones setting the goal, if you personally say it's time for me to get up, stop being so sedentary, and I'm going to do the following, and you set yourself a schedule. Remember, you're on a spectrum. Don't try to do it too fast. Don't try to do it too hard. You have to start getting gradually into condition, and as you're getting into condition and you start seeing your heart rate drop, which is good, then that means that your heart's getting healthier. It's also adding years on to your heart. You could add 10 to 20 extra years onto your heart if you did this. Now, let's just say that you're forced to do it. You had a heart attack or a stroke, and now your doctor says you've got to stop eating this junk food and you've got to start to exercise. The likelihood of sustaining that is less than if you decided to come to that on your own. So, and by the way, I remember once, what was her name? Mary Ann Trellis. Terrific. I mean, world-class athlete. And you knew you were doing well if you could keep pace with her in a race. She always won everything in the women's division. And she sponsored a race up in Connecticut. And it was a mall. I'd never raced in a mall before. And it was a big mall, and you had back and forth, back and forth. And before the race, I saw all these people in there. And I was talking to them, and they go there every morning because the mall is safe, and it's winterized and summerized, so the temperature is always good. And they do their workout. So once again, that philosophy of having a support system, even a mall. So we got to get into the idea of exercising. But this simply shows that when you're choosing to exercise and then you motivate yourself to start, you're much more likely not only to benefit, but to sustain it. Also, from Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, they compared seniors who relocate long distance, and it shows that where you live affects your longevity. So ask yourself this, would you like to live longer? Turns out that where you live, not just how you live, can make a big difference. I was asked once by someone doing a profile for an article, why'd I live in the woods, upstate New York for 14 years at the Fertler Farm? And I'd be up there on the weekends, and that's when we did our teaching classes on organic farming. And there was a core of us, Dr. Donald Mullen, who was with the Albert Ellis Institute, and he was also the chief psychologist at the Tri-State Healing Center for 15 years, and 10 years before that, when I just had a private practice, and he would try to show the power of positive thinking, something Norman Cousins wrote a great book on, and he would get people to understand that if you wake up in the morning and you have nothing to live for, and if you have a bad attitude and you're looking for something to justify that you're a victim, you'll find it. But also, that speeds up the disease and death process. And there were others before him who had acknowledged that. But he was keen on that. And I saw so many people's condition turn around after they were counseled by him. And he was just one of those super, super gentle human beings. Great guy. Anyhow, we had about 15 of us that love farming, love teaching, and we all volunteered to teach people. People learned a lot, thousands of people. I remember one day when I heard a knock at the door. I went to the door, and there was this older couple, and they said, we're just in the neighborhood, thought we'd drop by and see what you're doing here. So I said, sure. They were Scott and Helen Nearing. I mean, you talk about well-known people in the field of moving, having successful academic and careers and moving to show what it's like to live off the grid. They were the leaders in that. Very humble people, extremely knowledgeable. Everything they did themselves. And, you know, that was one of those remarkable days for me. But just being able to walk through the woods, just to sit on a log and watch nature, listen to nature, be mindful in that moment. So I know what it meant for me. I know what it's meant to live on an animal sanctuary in Florida for 25 years. The joy of seeing nature evolve, even at its worst, there's always a day when the sun comes back out and the storm has passed. So in any case, here's what this study found. The findings found that when you move to a location away from where you were, and you're part of the 10th percentile in terms of how much the area's enhanced longevity, you go to a place that is beautiful. You go to a place that is sustainable. You go to a place that is green. In whatever interpretation you want, you're going to live a longer life. How much longer? Just that alone. Just moving back to nature, 1.1 years. Now, that's a robust boost, considering that we just finished. And by the way, remember I told you 2 years ago I was commencing on a study, the first ever to show, could I take a group of people, put them in a controlled environment, and then everyone doing the same thing, how that could change their actual DNA, their actual hard, objective blood chemistry. It's not subjective. It's not subjective when you're measuring specific elements within the blood and in the cells before and after. It's subjective when you say, how do you feel? I feel better. Okay, well, that's subjective. But we, not only that, but even this morning, 4 o'clock this morning, I got an email saying that my article had been accepted for peer review publication, PubMed Journal, and listed journal. And that's a big deal. And it wasn't just me. It was Lou Anne Panisi and Dr. Ronald Klatz and Dr. Robert Goldman and Richard Gale and Roland Marconi, all the people who participated, Barbara Duncan, all the people who participated, John Q. There are probably 30 of us that participated. Now we're in our fifth study. Fifth study's coming up in a couple weeks. And again, you don't look at the difficulty and challenges of creating something and then doing it. You see what is the benefit and how can that lengthen other people's lives. I'm saying right now, there is no reason that anyone listening who chooses to change, not simple changes, major changes, could add 20 years onto their life from this day forward, and even longer, depending upon how much you were willing to incorporate. Just this one study shows 1.1 years to get out of the city, and yet people are not doing that. They're being forced out. But unfortunately, they're going from the city not always to a better place. And also, something we've been talking about for a long time, the University of Vienna, which is in Austria, found that biomarkers that indicate early brain injury in extremely extreme premature infants, the gut bacteria. So the early development of the gut, the brain, and the immune system are closely integrated. Therefore, whatever a mother eats and drinks will go through her breast milk and influence to the positive or negative the baby. And then what the baby starts to pick up epigenetically will influence it at the psychic level and the emotional level. And then what the baby then eats once they're off breast milk, all that's going to determine, do you have good gut bacteria or bad gut bacteria? Because then you're going to have either good immune development or bad immune development, good brain development or bad immune or brain development. So that's what this study shows. So really pay attention to the quality of the microorganisms going in your body. We're 20 minutes into our program. That's the latest on health and healing. One last one, University of Alabama found a combination of metabolite of leucine, L-E-U-C-I-N-E, glutamine, G-L-U-T-A-M-I-N-E, and arginine can improve vascular function and blood flow as you get older. That everyone benefits from. So just three simple things, amino acids you can put in there. We're at the end of our health nutrition segment. We're going to take a break. Now, here's what's going to happen. When we come back from the break, we're going to this professor. Again, I gave you his bio. He is one of the most respected professors for what he is, his field. He's checked off all the important to say, should we at least pay attention to what you're saying? He has no political or economic investment. He's non-political. He's non-ideological. He's simply saying when his team, a whole lot of other scientists, when they did the analysis, a major bedrock of everything the COVID pandemic rests upon was grossly flawed. It's a little technical, but watch it because he's going to be showing charts that were published in peer-reviewed journals so you can see them, download them. This is hard, objective scientific evidence, and that's what you will have. On the other side, you have grossly biased, politicized, weaponized opinions that don't mean diddly squat, yet they have the power, and you don't. Oh, and by the way, on tonight's Progressive Commentary Hour, we have one of the world's leading authorities on glyphosate and genetically engineered foods, Professor Senefa from MIT, with 4 degrees from MIT, including a PhD. And we are going to be sitting down to a long interview for the full hour on the politics of science, the corruption of science, the gaming of all science in the media, and how even the truth becomes a lie, and the lie is fed to us when we begin to believe it. So it's going to be a really insightful hour, and that'll be tonight at 7 p.m. Now we're going to take a break, but you can watch this discussion by going to prn.fm, scroll down to where it says Gary's Notes, and you can watch it in real time. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Research group became concerned right back in 2020 at the naive way in which statistics were driving the COVID narrative. So in particular, we were concerned at the failure to consider causal explanations for differences in observed case and fatality data. Now, the problem is that, as Claire has already indicated, all of the metrics are driven by the definition of a COVID case. So obviously we've got the number of cases, which I might be one at the moment, the number of hospitalizations, number of deaths. And even if the definition of a case was something that everybody agreed with, the fact that we're not told any of the critical additional metrics, namely how many of those cases are asymptomatic, how many of the hospitalizations are for something other than COVID, or only got COVID after hospitalization, and similarly, how many of those died with COVID, not from COVID. So even if we were agreed on what a COVID case was, we're never told those critical additional metrics. And of course, things are much worse because, again, as Claire's made clear, a COVID case, we now know, is simply just a positive PCR test. And so it can include all of these classes of people. Those would be the true positives, but we've also got the false positives. So those are the false positives. Those are the true positives. And again, as Claire has indicated, there's some doubts about really whether those should be people who have the virus but never develop symptoms and test positive, whether they are actually true positives at all. Now, again, as Claire explained, there are multiple possible causes for false positives. And in particular, for asymptomatic testing, which became increasingly widespread from the summer of 2020, this is really problematic. And there's a lot of misunderstanding about what false positives are. So just give us kind of like an explanation, a graphical explanation. Let's suppose that an asymptomatic person tests positive, and there's a 1% false positive rate, i.e. 1 in 100 people who don't have the virus would test positive. Now, most people assume that a person testing positive likely has the virus. but it actually all depends on the underlying infection rate. Suppose that that rate is 1 in 1,000. Let's imagine that we test 10,000 asymptomatic people. Then we know that about 10 of those really have the virus. And so let's assume that they test positive. But because of the 1% false positive rate, about 100 of those who don't have the virus will also test positive. So out of the 110 in total who test positive, only 10 actually has the virus. And so if you test positive, there's actually less than 10% chance that you have the virus, meaning that under these assumptions, the vast majority of so-called asymptomatic cases are false positives. And in fact, with some real data, we see exactly this kind of pattern. Now, up until December 2020, when I was frequently doing analyses based on the official case data, I was highlighting the problem of showing case number plots without taking account the number of tests performed. So I'd produce comparative plots like this. But of course, these plots don't factor in the false positives. So we started to look for other key indicators, the most obvious and easily available of which were the NHS dashboard data for COVID triages. And this is highly revealing. So this was from December. You can see that the triage data at the top shows the real epidemic last spring, but just a kind of like a normal autumn increase. And that's in stark contrast to what the case data, that simply the number of cases was showing, which was, of course, driven by a massive increase in number of people tested. And that difference has continued. You can see here, this was from the last time I looked at this, this was from May. And those are matched up, the top and the bottom are matched up in dates. And so actually, I thought it's actually pointless to use the official case data for anything. In fact, in March, we also discovered that the Lighthouse Labs were classifying positive cases on the basis of a single target gene call when the WHO guidelines was a minimum of 2. So that means that in some weeks, as many as 50% of all those classified as cases were by definition false positives. Now, all of these issues come to the fore when we look at the propaganda campaign mounted with this misleading data. This highly repeated 1 in 3 claim. Now, what is true is that when the virus is fairly widespread, around 1 in 3 people who test positive, that's as opposed to who have the virus, have no symptoms. But so what? To show how ludicrous that is, if the virus was completely eliminated, this statement would have to say every person who has COVID-19 has no symptoms. And using data from a study of asymptomatics at Cambridge University, we were able to show how ludicrous the 1 in 3 claim is. So in 6 weeks over last winter, an average of about 5,000 asymptomatics were tested per week in pools of sizes about 3 to 5. And so there were in total 43 pools out of about 10,500 tested positive. But after confirmatory testing, just 6 of the 43 pools were found to be positive. And that was a single individual in each pool. So 36 out of the 10,000 or so pools tested were false positives. And although that means the false positive rate was only about 0.35%, 84% of the positives were false. And of course, we don't know if any of the six people who went on to develop, whether they actually went on to develop symptoms. And even if they did, we still can't be sure that they weren't also false positives, because the confirmatory test was also a PCR test. So overall, on average, about 1 in 5,000 asymptomatics per week were confirmed positive at a time when the ONS was estimating that 1 in 120 people in Cambridge genuinely had the virus. Now, we showed that if the 1 in 3 claim was correct, then the ONS estimated infection rate would be over 8 times greater than the true rate. And conversely, if the ONS infection rate is correct, then the maximum possible value for the proportion of people with the virus with no symptoms is 1 in 26 and not 1 in 3 as claimed. And finally, the problems with the PCR test also undermine the results of demonstrating vaccine effectiveness, since it's the comparison between cases in vaccinated and unvaccinated that determine effectiveness. So in large observational trials such as this one, a flawed definition of a case is massively compounded by the fact that there are completely different testing strategies for the unvaccinated. Basically, asymptomatic unvaccinated people were tested regularly, while asymptomatic vaccinated people were not. So if you don't test the vaccinated, you won't find any cases among them. And if you continually test the unvaccinated, you'll find lots of cases, almost all false positives. Now, months on, The Lancet has still not published our rapid response letter highlighting the flaws in this study. So, what have the following questions got in common? How many COVID cases are there? How many COVID hospitalizations are there? How many COVID deaths are there? And how effective are the COVID vaccines? And the answer is that even after 17 months, we have no idea at all. Thank you.
Okay, there you have it. One of the world's leading people did the research with his team, and they're saying, we don't know anything, except there's an awful lot of false positives, because they've tried to convert a false positive as a case, but it's not. And we've been way off by a magnitude in his, one of the statistics he's read there was 800% off. And I've been saying from the very beginning, the PCR test is not an accurate and reliable diagnostic test to tell you if you have an active infection from the COVID or not. Can't even tell you whether it's a new or old COVID. You could have had a cold 10 years ago and still be testing positive based upon how many magnifications have you done. And they know this. They're playing a game because in the FDA's own, CDC's own documents, I read down and there it says vaccinated people will receive a PCR test afterwards at 28 cycles instead of the typical 45. So at 45, you're going to have the massive majority of people test positive, but they're not infected. They don't have the virus. And the people who are testing negative, who have just 26 or 28 cycle repetition, they may have the virus but it's not being detected. So you see, everything that they've done on this is wrong. But they've managed to control through just brute politics and weaponization all the information. All these doctors, now there's a law trying to be passed that you cannot fly anywhere in the United States. It's in Congress now. There's also rules that they want every state medical board to pass, that if you're a practicing board-certified physician, if you're licensed to practice medicine in the state, if you make any disparaging remark about anything involving COVID, you could lose your license. This is not open and honest and fair debate. This is fascism, absolute fascism. So, and also, did you read Cheryl Atkinson's latest post? Because again, it's under my notes today, and Cheryl Atkins, you know, is a multi-Emmy award-winning producer and host, and she, quote, fake news, how an ivermectin story got amplified around the world when nobody seemed to check the facts. Quote, Rolling Stone had to retract a false story it published claiming an Oklahoma hospital had been overrun by people who were poisoned themselves with the COVID-19 treatment ivermectin, and that had resulted in gunshot victims and others being turned away or were left waiting for emergency care. The story was published amid propagandists working overtime to try to controversialize the COVID-19 therapy, ivermectin, and which public health officials disparage and recommend against, but many physicians and scientists insist is proving highly effective in some cases. And much of the misleading propaganda implied ivermectin is a horse medicine dangerous to people. It omitted the fact that there is an approved human ivermectin. And above, an FDA photo associates ivermectin with horses, even though it's approved for use in humans. After the false story was published, the hospital issued a statement that promoted a correction. Quote, turns out that the one doctor quoted in the story hadn't worked in the hospital in months, and the hospital had treated no patients resulted in ivermectin. None. Zero. Additionally, the hospital said that it had not turned away or delayed any patients in the ER. By the way, the New York Times and all the media, all of them are attacking the therapies that are actually safe and effective and work. So what does that tell you? I'd like your thoughts. Why would something that saves lives, and by the way, these really highly qualified scientists and medical doctors have all accepted that had we been using a mixed combination of vitamin D, vitamin C, zinc, and zinc is the real killer of the virus, and also ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, and anticlonal antibodies, that we would have saved 85% of all the people who've died. And yet no one's taking responsibility for that. They want you to take a worthless, dangerous drug. So, why? What are your thoughts? 888-874-4888. I'm going to, and by the way, all over the world, people are now protesting. If you saw the videos I was watching yesterday from France, millions of people protesting, and rightly so. If you just keep saying okay to everything the government says, then you must assume that the government is honest and has your interests at stake. And when has that ever been the case? Name me that instance. I'd like to hear. When they were telling you that cigarette smoking was okay and knew that it wasn't, when they allowed DDT and heptachlor and Agent Orange to be spread on people and consumed in their food, that was okay? No, you better. Nobody can be that delusional. So anyhow, when they get on the line, we'll talk to them in a moment. In the interim, I'm going to go to a clip. This is very revealing. This is a clip from Gravitas, and in India, they do some outstanding reporting, and they're going to tell you who's behind and how they're doing it. Destroying the last of the resistance, the people, the soldiers who had gone to this area to hold a last final stand against the Taliban, and who was responsible for them being destroyed. And you know that the Taliban are going to destroy every single one of those tens of thousands of soldiers and the citizens that housed them there and the women. This is the beginning of a carnage. And we can thank our administration for participating. But here's the people that we should have condemned a long time ago. And we didn't. We've been feeding them money, billions of dollars. And they're really evil.
The military orchestrated the onslaught. The ISI chief landed in Kabul to oversee operations. They have dropped all pretense. Pakistan has used the Taliban to invade Afghanistan and rule by proxy. And the world is not just a mute spectator. It is ready to pay Pakistan to manage the Afghan crisis. It's so bizarre and incredible. It makes you wonder what kind of men and women are running the world as leaders. They're complicit in the Afghan tragedy. They remain silent on Pakistan's role. Well, here's a fact. The Taliban were in no position to enter Panjshir. They had been outflanked by the Northern Alliance. Pakistan's support changed that. And the support was as open as it gets. On Saturday, the ISI chief landed in Kabul. Lieutenant General Faiz Hamid, the chief of Pakistan's Inter-Services Intelligence, or ISI. What was he in Kabul for? Apparently to settle disputes in the Taliban. The Rehbari Shura was divided on government formation, so the quote-unquote Rawalpindi Shura had to intervene. The Pakistani military is dictating government formation in Kabul. When the ISI chief reached Kabul, he was asked about the purpose of the visit. Here's what he said.
Your people in the Taliban?
No, I'm not clear. He may be able to arrange
that. What do you hope will come out of this, what do you hope is going to happen now in Afghanistan? What is your best hope?
I have just landed and
we are working for peace and stability in Afghanistan.
Don't worry. Everything will be okay.
Peace and stability in Afghanistan. That's Rich coming from the chief of a rogue intel agency. A top Pakistani security official quoted by news agency Reuters told a different story altogether. He said the ISI chief was in Afghanistan to help the Taliban reorganize the Afghan military. And it doesn't take a genius to know what the aim of this reorganization was. To lay siege on Panjshir. On Sunday afternoon, the Taliban's onslaught began. All accounts from Panjshir indicate that this was an ISI-led assault, that the Pakistani Air Force used drones to drop bombs on Panjshir, with troops from Pakistan's Special Service Group assisting the Taliban on ground. All of this happened under the command of ISI Chief Faiz Hamid. And this is not hearsay. This has been verified by journalists and resistance fighters in Panjshir. Let me show you one account posted by a French journalist. This was from Sunday evening. He said there's credible information to state that Pakistan's commandos are in Panjshir with Pakistan's Cobra helicopters operating in the air. What were they doing there? The next post was from an Afghan commando fighting in the Panjshir Valley. He said, and I'm quoting, "I've got a few seconds of satellite internet. We are being bombed by Pakistani drones. We are under direct invasion of ISI. Spread our word. Our civilians are under target. This could be my last tweet forever if you don't hear me in some days. And this was 24 hours back, and we haven't heard from him since then. Could this be a coincidence? That on Saturday, the ISI chief lands in Kabul, and the next day, the Taliban enters Panjshir. This is no coincidence. This is an open military intervention by Pakistan, an invasion. And it should weigh heavily on the conscience of world leaders, if they have any left. Thousands of Afghans are being bombarded endlessly by the Taliban and its conjoined twin Pakistan. Not just those fighting on the front lines. But the 150,000 people who call Panjshir home, they're all under threat. Their lives are about to get upended. They're about to lose their liberties and their way of life. But Western leaders could not care less. Their ministers are making a beeline for Pakistan. They're planting saplings in Islamabad and pledging millions in aid to the Pakistani government. This includes the foreign ministers of Germany, Italy, the Netherlands and the UK. All four of them visited Islamabad last week. They promised to protect the quote-unquote right to dignity of Afghans. Will they speak up for Panjshir too? Will they call out Pakistan for invading Afghanistan to rule by proxy? Will they probe Pakistan for Panjshir? They won't. For the West, Pakistan is a blind spot in their so-called war on terror. Leading this trend is the United States of America. I'll give you examples. They found Osama bin Laden in Pakistan, but they did not sanction the country. They placed a $10 million bounty on Hafiz Saeed, but they won't speak about Pakistan's patronage to this terrorist. As recent as last year, they caught four Pakistanis for the Paris terror attack, but they did not say a word on how the Pakistani deep state nourishes such terrorists. Now Pakistan is bombing Panjshir after installing a terrorist group on the throne of Kabul. What does it get from the West? Offers of cooperation in managing this crisis. Vyond is now available in your...
So Pakistan has been harboring the Taliban and other terrorist groups for years. It has been supplying money and intelligence all along. And when the Afghan terrorist groups needed help or recovery from wounds, they would go into Pakistan. No word of this by the mainstream media. None. So just understand the poor people of Afghanistan are in for some brutal times ahead, and everyone's going to be there to exploit it. And by the way, I'll share something tomorrow with you about how China is now negotiating to take over the Bagram Air Base. And, wow. And yet no one says they saw this coming. And they were negotiating all this months before the Taliban was in a position to take down the government. Yeah, our intelligence agencies listened to every phone call. They knew everything. Let's go over real quick. I'm going to say hello to someone I've known for a long time. In fact, she was responsible for getting me my first regular appearances on Good Morning New York and then AM New York, Alice Fennell. She's a multi-award-winning, Emmy Award-winning producer, executive producer at ABC. Nice to have you with us today, Alice.
Hello, Gary. Nice to be here.
Alice, this will be short, but I need people to know that industry interfering in programming is not new. This has been going on for decades, and you were there when a television series that had been greenlit and we were doing for ABC on health, non-controversial topic, one day it was just killed. And it was killed because someone who is a professor at a local university heard that I was doing this and then made some calls and was able to get this thing done. Is that correct or not?
That's correct. It's this is a very sad time for me as far as media is concerned. There doesn't seem to be integrity anymore. There was at one time. It used to be that if you wanted to have a station on the air, you had to subscribe to the FCC and to operating in the public interest, convenience, and necessity. That was drummed into us when we were students. And I don't know where it went to. It's gone. You don't get the whole story anymore. It used to be that if a reporter or journalist was able to find more than one side of a story, maybe two, three, even more, that was a coup for that person. And he or she would do their damnedest to get that story. It's not happening anymore. We're not getting all sides. We're not getting all the facts. So our journalism is meaningless compared to what it was when you and I were doing shows.
Yeah, and we had a popular program every week. It was the top-rated morning program in the New York area.
Yes.
And we actually allowed time. It was as much as 13 to 16 minutes to talk on an issue. Today, it's 4 minutes, if you're lucky.
If you're lucky, yes.
So you come from a different era. You come from an area where there was some integrity, creativity, and standards. And you were rewarded with being an executive a producer, winning all those Emmys you won. But that's all gone now. It's gone, and it's not coming back. Everything in media has been captured from PBS and NPR. It's all been captured. Just wanted to verify what I had said to the audience, that person intervened, reached out to the top person at ABC, killed the series. We were paid, but they were killed the series. Why? Because they didn't want something on health. Our kind of health, yes, they didn't want to hear that. But cornflakes health, yeah, that all day long. Thank you very much, Alice Fennell. Okay. Now let's go over to Richard Gale. Richard, we don't have a lot of time, and I want to see if we can't get some calls in. We're going to say goodbye at 55-minute so the BAI can go to its news, but we're going to continue to top the hour because I'd like people to call in, and I'd like them to try to address this question. Why is it that people are now moving to the most dangerous places in the United States? Places that are on fire, places that have been flooded, places that are in hurricane's way. And you would think it would be just the opposite. People would be looking for sustainable places to move to, and that's just the opposite. Boy, this was just out, but tell us how bad it's been in the last 30 days for people who question whether or not we should be doing something now at the local, federal, state level, and nothing is being done at the local, federal, state, or national level. So we're in it alone. You're either going to do something on your own or you're going to be a victim of your own hubris. Take it away.
Yeah, well, we just recently saw just as the kind of flooding that just occurred in New Jersey with, I think, close to, what, 24 people were killed. It was some of the most, as well as destructive tornadoes that hit the Northeast, and these were unprecedented torrents that inundated large swaths of the greater New York City area. But we have, throughout this summer, there was record highs in the northwest heat waves that we saw. And we're witnessing very, very unusual weather phenomena that has never been seen before. One I've been thinking of in particular is the fire clouds that were appearing in Western Canada, where there would be like 710,000 lightning strikes just within 15 hours. This is something that was throughout British Columbia and Northwestern Alberta provinces in Canada. But these are phenomena that are really bewildering meteorologists and weather scientists, and they haven't been able to account for. But across the world, we've been witnessing just record-breaking heat waves and flooding and strange meteorological phenomena throughout. And the United Nations, there was a report that just recently came out that they're just saying that it's the worst is yet to come.
Go through them right now, Richard, go through the worst case scenario. What has just happened in the last 30 days? Go down your list, please, of the last 30 days. I want to drive into people's consciousness how serious the weather has been.
Right. Dangerous northwest heat wave smashes all-time records of temperatures. So that would be up in Washington and Oregon. Another one, climate-driven weather disasters increased fivefold over the past 50 years. That was through the United Nations Atmospheric Agency. Greenhouse gas levels are the highest ever seen, and that's going back 800,000 years. Economic devastation from climate crisis will be like two COVID-19 pandemics per year by 2050. I just mentioned that one concerning the United Nations report. There are now a billion children at extreme risk from the climate impact. Siberian wildfires dwarfed all others on Earth combined. And for the first time in history, smoke had reached the North Pole. We're speaking about the very polar apex. Highest recorded temperatures in Europe were in Sicily, 121 degrees Fahrenheit in Sicily. There's this great fear of the Gulf Stream system that could collapse, and scientists are coming out saying that we can't allow this to happen. There was big wildfires in Hawaii, the largest wildfires in its history. There was the thousands that were evacuated from Athens in Greece as wildfires raged. There's been this enormous meltdown in Greenland. Scientists are just saying we're reaching all these tipping points now. They're right on our doorstep at this point. The Arctic is warming three times faster than the rest of the Earth. And now they're making claims that Asia cities are going to be the worst hit in the warming world. These are going to be, a city like Jakarta and Delhi and Chennai and even Wuhan was mentioned in that report. We're going to be discovering one-third of the global food production is being threatened. There was a study that came out of Finland. The fire clouds I mentioned, and then the Earth is now trapping more heat than it is repelling back. So that was a tipping point that was passed. That's a newer tipping point. That's one we haven't been mentioning before, but we've now passed this tipping point where the Earth, and particularly Amazon in particular, is now containing the heat rather than reverting it back. So that's the scenario. Okay. Just within the past 2 months, really.
And I thank you. I appreciate that, Richard. What I'm concerned with is that with all the knowledge we have, with all the firsthand experience that we've had, when people have drowned to death in New York City in basement apartments, our response is to focus upon the tragedy of the individual, the crisis when something happens where they, quote, lose everything, and we are ill-prepared. For example, in New Orleans, there are still hundreds of thousands of people without electricity. Why didn't they send in the commercial generators prior to the storm? Why didn't they open up a gigantic water and food bank prior to the storm so people could have a place to go to, food to eat, and even a clinic where there'd be medical help in case they suffered any injuries? They didn't. They didn't do it anywhere in America at any time, ever. So what does it say when we have an agency that only responds after an event, never before? I said years ago when I was seeing how many people were killed because of the monsoon, and I said, why doesn't the Pakistani government and the Indian government build gigantic? They have the resources, they have the technology, certainly. They have the engineering staff. They have a lot of brain power. Why don't they build, let's say, 1 million square foot centers above ground out of concrete with drains, with generators on the roof, but they divide it up, families, singles, an open cafeteria 24/7, clinics that if you need help, you have help, counseling, and resource center where people can see what they have to do if what they had come from was all destroyed. Nothing. So here's my point. I'm going to say my point. I want to hear from a couple people in the audience. Let's say hello to Greg from New Jersey. Hi, Greg. Your turn.
The other day, and I look back at my life 20 years ago here in northwestern New Jersey, a whole group of us got together stopping building from where in the watershed where we live, and with stormwater runoff and a million other things they knew nothing about but we learned about, and we stopped them by a million different things. Our part, our little area here in New Jersey did not get affected by that because we're not in low-lying areas and where water runs off and floods and all the horrible things. The thing is, when I've been hearing from you for years, and especially Admiral David Titley out in Penn State, who's been talking about this for years, this is only beginning. And folks from New Jersey, New York, retiring, moving to Florida, moving to Arizona, don't they see what the heck's going on? It's only starting.
You are correct. And as Richard Gale just mentioned, when that circular motion of warm water from South America going up towards Greenland, going up past, let's say, Scotland, Ireland, and coming back down, when that slows down, that's going to cause a massive change in temperature. That whole area, hundreds of millions of people will be adversely affected. No one's doing anything about it. No one. So here's my position at this moment. I believe that the only opportunity we have is to work with one another, small groups. If you're going to wait for a corporation or a Silicon Valley solution, which will be a non-solution, or governmental agency, or the media pundits, no one is doing anything. We're moving in the wrong direction to the wrong places because we're cognitively disconnected from cause and effect in our own reality. That tells me a lot about why people are so easily motivated to always take the line of least resistance and say, I'm going to move to, as you said, Arizona, which has run out of water. And now the Hoover Dam and Lake Mead is so low that it can't supply all 40 million people, including those in Arizona, with the water they need, or Nevada. And yet more people are moving to Nevada. And they're saying, here's the good stuff. I don't want to pay attention to the negative things that could happen. This is really, really dangerous. So, friends, you're on your own. No one's going to save you. No one's going to rescue you. All you're going to do is see the same absolutely idiotic programs will come after an event never before. We should have areas where people simply should not be allowed to live, like in California is one, Oregon, and yes, the second one. But then again, I could add a lot of other places because they're just not sustainable. So these disasters are just beginning. So as bad as it is now, wait to see what happens with food supplies and food availability in a year from now. Then you'll see how prophetic these comments are today. Greg, thank you very much for your being on today and sharing your thoughts. Again, if we're editing down my 8 hours and on saving COVID to make it more manageable for people to listen to, but a part of that is best places to live. When that's all done, I'll let you all know. Have a nice day, everyone.